What does it mean to be a man? Cheryl Spencer, a woman, attended the Journeyman Symposium, Paths to Masculinity, that was held at the Arboretum in January. She's here with some audio clips and her own impressions of the symposium. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi, Jennifer.
So, why did you decide to attend a symposium on masculinity?
Well, I'm over 40, I'm married, I have children, and over the years I've been doing a lot of thinking about what it means to be a woman. I've been thinking about things like gender differences, what are true gender differences, what are culturally imposed differences. And for a woman, I've been wondering about the nitty-gritty things, the balance between paid and unpaid work, raising one's children, and living an authentic life. So I saw the ad for the Journeyman Symposium, and it struck me that here might be a gathering of men who've been thinking about some of the same things, but from a male point of view. So I thought it would be neat to see what they were up to.
And what did you find?
Well, I thought I might be a fly on the wall. In fact, I thought I might be the only woman at the symposium. But I was very surprised to find that, in fact, the ratio of men to women there was about 50-50. The symposium was organized by a planning committee headed by Rob Baldwin from Counseling Services here at the university and Carrie Daly from the Department of Family Relations and Applied Nutrition. And it was their intention from the start to make it accessible to as many people as possible in terms of format as well as gender. I spoke to Rob Baldwin, and here's what he had to say about that.
One of the things we wanted to do was not just have an intellectual happening. We didn't want it just to be academic and intellectual. That was important, but we also wanted it to be experiential. So we tried to choose a cross-section of lecture-style information research, as well as men just simply telling their stories. It's an interesting kind of smorgasbord of what's going on for men, and it just touches on a few things, but it opens up a dialogue, and we wanted to provide a forum for having this kind of dialogue and this kind of conversation, and a place where men and women together can come together and start talking about these things.
So it really was a smorgasbord. The conference took place over a Friday afternoon and through a Saturday. There were two keynote addresses, two panels, a presentation, a concert on the Friday night, as well as lots of time for questions and discussion.
So what was the initial motivation for organizing the symposium?
Well, last year was the first Journeyman Symposium, and it was a smaller event, mainly focused on students. But it did really well and attracted a lot of interest from the broader community, and the organizers were definitely building on that. But I asked Rob Baldwin what motivated him to organize a conference on paths to masculinity in the first place.
I think primarily my counseling work with men and also my own work on myself. It became really obvious when I started working with other men that there are so many issues that men struggle with, but it's very difficult to get to them often. And when we started working with the students here, and when we began the Journeyman's group for students on campus, we started finding that the young men on campus really wanted a place to talk about these things, that there was a whole population of young men who wanted to talk about what was going on internally, not just externally, but that it was really hard to find a place to do that.
So from here, Jennifer, we'll be Journey Women at the Journeyman Symposium, and I'll just take you through it as it happened. So the first keynote speaker was Fred Matthews. He's a community psychologist and director of Central Toronto Youth Services. He also has tons of other experience as a lecturer as well as a consultant to governments on the topic of youth at risk. Fred's presentation was entitled "The Normalization of Shaming and Blaming in the Socialization of Young Boys and Men."
My gosh, what does that mean?
Well, I asked if it was about my 11 and 13-year-old sons calling each other derogative names. But Fred Matthews thinks it's a much larger issue than that. And he says that, in fact, our whole culture is slow to pick up on boys' issues and that there are blind spots which allow boys to be shamed and blamed into masculinity. He also believes that we've set up a situation where boys aren't encouraged or they're even afraid to admit or acknowledge that they've been victimized. So I spoke to Fred Matthews, and here's his explanation of his talk.
The normalization of shaming and blaming is something we do culturally to boys, as It's how we socialize boys into masculinity and into manhood. And part of the scripts that you would recognize the normalization of shaming and blaming in would be things like we accuse boys of being gay if they don't match certain stereotypes of masculinity. Girls will do it in their intimate relationships when they insult a boy who may not be ready for sex by accusing him of being gay, or will not. We say a guy hasn't made it if he can't take care of himself. You know, he can't, or if he gets beat up by a girl, or he's a sissy. If he is abused, we often minimize the victimization experiences of boys and say, you know, why didn't you take care of yourself, or why did you let that happen? You know, boys hear messages all the time from the culture. You know, you're not tall enough. You're not muscular enough. You're not. You don't drive a fast enough car. You know, the short male is the perennial whipping boy for all kinds of jokes and gags. And also, too, there are certain stereotypes about boys that we believe that all males are ready for sexual experiences from the early stages of their lives, and that if an older person, an older female in particular, teaches a young boy about sex, that's called initiation into life. Whereas if you flip the genders around and it was an adult man doing it to a young girl, we would see it for what it is. It's a sexual exploitation or outright sexual abuse. So, and when we talk about aggression, we often say that, you know, boys are the aggressive sex, when all of the research that's done on aggression worldwide says that both genders are equally aggressive. And certainly up to about the age of puberty, that manifests in pretty much the same ways. A lot of it's verbal. A lot of it is indirect forms of aggression. After puberty, I think you see much more of a distinct representation of boys in the physical violence part, and girls are more in the indirect forms of aggression and violence. But when we say that, that boys are the aggressive sex, we leave out, of course, if they're ever victimized through violence, then it's almost like an anomaly, because if they're the perpetrators, how do we deal with them when they're victimized? So there's a lot of, I think we have a lot of the stories that have been told about violence and victimization in our culture have come from women, because they were the first ones to name their experiences and have much more permission to talk about their victimization experiences. That's neither good or bad. That's just the way the history is unfolded. And boys are struggling to have their voice added to those discussions, because they have to get over the hurdle of the fact that simply identifying themselves as victims is a diminishment of their status as boys or young men. So these are just a few examples of the kind of normalization of shaming and blaming that goes on, and you see it in assumptions around masculinity. You see it in the way boys are treated in the school system. There are a lot of folks who would claim that girls get a raw deal in the school system. I would argue both genders get a raw deal in the school system, and sometimes for similar and sometimes for different reasons. But we know a lot more about girl stories because we have women who are advocating. We don't have the same advocates coming forward and talking about boy stories, so their stories have yet to really achieve any kind of public awareness or professional awareness, for that matter. So there's lots of ways boys are silenced. There's lots of messages they get that blame them and shame them, and they are invisible to us because they're normal, natural parts of parenting, schooling. They're in the academy and the way we think about how we do our research, the questions we ask. There's lots of silences and gaps and holes in our understanding.
So how was Fred Matthews' talk received?
Well, it was interesting. I spoke to a couple of women who were at the symposium, and they said that they felt their hackles go up during Fred Matthews' talk. They wish that he talked more about all children rather than just boys. And the picture that Fred Matthews painted did seem very depressing, but it did make me think of potential double standards that I was allowing to happen in my own house. According to Fred Matthews, however, much, much broader change has to come.
I think the most important thing for those who believe in real social justice and real equality have got to be prepared to step back from the discussions or the discourse on equality, and start including boys' stories. We need to be critical of newspaper stories that blame and shame boys. We need to, in our dating violence or our relational violence literature, add boys' stories so that they can account for their experiences of being shamed in their relationships. We need to look at the normalization of violence towards male children in terms of abusive child-rearing practices. We tend to hit boys more. We need to look at a lot of the ways we classify mental illnesses and other disorders in boys when those diagnostic categories actually hide victimization experiences of those boys. In fact, a lot of what we label as conduct disorders or oppositional defiant disorders are boys simply acting out as a result of a history of abuse. So a lot of male victims hide in those categories. So those in the helping professionals have got to learn that boys' language of emotions, depression, may be different from girls. In the school system, we've got to recognize that boys are starting to fall behind the girls in terms of school completion, school failure. Those are just a few of the forums in which I think we need to start making some changes.
Interesting.
Yes, it was. It provided lots of food for thought.
So what was next?
Well, there was a panel presentation called Generations of Men, Stories from the Ages, and it was fascinating. The organizers arranged for four well-spoken, articulate men of four different generations to talk for about 15 minutes each about their lives, and not just about what they did when, but triumphs, failures, relationships, and especially loss. And really and truly, they spoke about what it was like for them to be men at each stage of their lives. What I found most moving in this panel was Trevor Dickinson. He's a retired professor and he was the elder of the group. And he spoke about, among other things, finding that he had cancer and realizing that he didn't know how to receive love and support from others. And his emotion about that really filled the room. The whole panel was a testament to the power of sharing stories and one of the most moving aspects of the symposium.
So how was the evening concert?
Well, I wish I had been able to be there in person, but I couldn't go. But the concert featured Tom Wilson from Blackie and the Rodeo Kings. There were storytellers, there were students sharing poetry, and a Japanese drum ensemble. And I did hear a recording of the drums, and it sounded like very powerful medicine.
So that brings us to the second day of the symposium.
Yes, which began with an address from the other keynote speaker, who was Ian Brown. And if you're a Globe and Mail reader or a listener to CBC Radio, you will probably have encountered Ian Brown. He's a very well-known journalist. He's the host of Talking Books on CBC Radio, among other things. But what I think he's most known for are his ruminations on manhood. I've encountered essays by Ian Brown on everything from boxers, as in the sport, to boxers, as in underwear. And he's traveled and talked to countless men to create a TV documentary and then a book called Man Overboard. And Ian Brown's take is that being a man in the 21st century means basically that you are confused because all the rules are up for grabs. And his presentation was on the portrayal of men in the media, but I asked him why he spends so much time thinking and writing on the role of men.
Well, because I'm one of these, I'm an Anglican, and I, you know, the Anglicans, they don't have confession, you know, and they don't have a forgiving God, you know, the Anglicans are... you're born an asshole and you stay an asshole, you know. So you do everything you can to not feel like an asshole. And I don't, I'm open to these ideas. I'm quite porous. I'm a reporter, you know. I take things in and I'm susceptible. But the result is that people, you know, have no compunction or hesitation to tell me exactly what they feel. And, you know, I don't want to be responsible for the oppression of women. I don't think I am, but many women would tell me that I'm part of the problem because I'm a man. I think that's unfair. That's one of the reasons I think about it. I think about it because the rules have changed, because my father was a great father, but a quiet man, and I can't do things the way he did them because the society's different. You know, he went to work all the time, worked at work, and was great at work and could be controlled and stuff. I can't do that because my wife works too. So I have to figure it out anew, you know. I want to be as good a dad, as good a husband as he was, but in different circumstances. So that's, you know, it's an interesting challenge. It's like a hobby, you know. Philosophy is a hobby. Yeah. philosophy is plumbing.
He's very funny about it.
Yes, he is. But even so, I think he really does take these issues very seriously. In fact, he feels that the issue of how men and women get along may be one of the great issues of all time.
In a way, you know, it feels like... It's kind of like, you know, there have been a number of great conversations in the history of the world. The conversation over slavery was one of them. The conversation about having, you know, the Second World War was one of them. There's been one about industrialism. I think the conversation about sharing politics and power between men and women as a result of women's liberation, about the end of a kind of slavery, I think that could be one of the great conversations. You know, I'd like to be part of it.
So what does Ian Brown think about the portrayal of men in the media?
Well, not much, actually. In his talk, he pointed to several different television characters, especially Ray in Everybody Loves Raymond, and really painted them as ineffectual dolts. In fact, Ian Brown advised that if you want to address the question of what it is to be a man, that you should avoid the mass media, as it has other completely contradictory goals.
The media wants to sell a lot of papers, you know. The media wants to get a lot of people watching the TV, a lot of people using the internet, you know. And to get them there, you've got to say, all right, I've got something that interests all of you. I've got an answer that speaks to everybody. Everybody needs this. Whereas in my experience of talking to people, to men in particular, is that they're better off if they go through their own trial by fire, their own challenge, you know, whether it's climbing a mountain or building a bookshelf or planting a garden or becoming an expert on apple trees or raising your daughter and teaching her to ski or... you know, reading political diaries or whatever you can become obsessive and compulsive about, you know. Those are... those are better ways of doing it. You know, they're individual responses. I think anybody who looks to TV to help them out, I mean... I just don't trust it.
I got talking to Ian Brown about the movie Lost in Translation and how it was a very new and interesting depiction of a modern man. And he agreed, but he said that movie really isn't in the mainstream. And once again, he came down hard on the media and especially network television.
We all want to think the same thing. We all want one gadget that allows us to communicate that one thing over and over again. I mean, there's this incessant conversation that goes on via cell phone, via this, via that, all these intrusive things. But 95% of what gets said is the same 5% of information, the same 5% of human experience repeated again and again and again and again and again. 95% of the world is untouched. That's the way to find yourself, is to find the stuff that interests you that no one else is talking about. And there's tons of it, you know. So why go with the mass media? Why go with, you know, network television? Yuck.
Again, he's quite funny.
He is. He's a very provocative and clever man. But next on the agenda was another panel discussion, this one on diverse paths of masculinity. And again, it was a powerful panel, one or another group of men, one a transsexual, one a survivor of horrific childhood abuse, told their stories. And there was such power in their stories, and collectively they demonstrated that men, or all people, whatever their history or past that they take, that they just can't be herded or cajoled into a stereotype. And it was really refreshing.
So did the symposium end there?
Well, there was one last presentation, and that was on men in intimate relationships. And it was presented by Dr. Catherine Greenaway and Dr. John Tice, who are not only both psychologists, but life partners as well. And the presentation took an interesting format, where first they showed a series of clips from mainstream movies, showing men in various intimate relationships, some succeeding, some failing. And then they proceeded to have a conversation based on the clips, their experiences with their clients, and, in fact, their own life experiences, too. And there's a story that I have to tell you, Jen, and it took place during this presentation. An attendee of the symposium, I guess there must have been something about the presentation that moved him somehow. And he moved to the front of the presentation area, and he began to engage John Tice in a conversation. And at first I thought that this gentleman was a plant, that he'd been asked to join the presentation. And then I realized that what was happening wasn't scripted. So I saw Rob Baldwin approach the man, and I thought, oh, he's going to ask him to leave or to sit down again. And do you know what Rob Baldwin did?
No.
He handed the fellow a microphone. And I thought that that was one of the nicest, most inclusive acts I've ever witnessed. To me, it said so much. It said, you're not part of the plan here, but we welcome you anyway. And so this gentleman said his piece, and then the presenters continued. So that was pretty much it, Jen. Everyone left after that, perhaps a little wiser, perhaps with more questions than when they arrived. But after all was said and done, I did talk with two students who attended the symposium. Jason Perriman, a fifth-year biological engineering student, and Daniel Mercer, who is in his last year of rural planning and development. And they felt they should come to the symposium for a few reasons. To find out what might come ahead for them as men, to counter the quarter-life crisis, as Jason put it, and to get tools for self-expression, although I don't think either of them needs these. So I asked them what the main thing was that each of them would take away, and here's Jason.
I think it would be learning that it is important to figure out what makes you tick. And definitely as being a man, like, it's harder for us. Well, it's a different process than it would be if you were a woman. And there aren't examples of how to do that. It's not in the media. It's not prevalent. Men aren't generally expected to do the self-discovery thing or to be emotional or spiritual. So I think listening to the panelists and just seeing what kind of being here and experiencing the workshops kind of showed me the importance of always embarking on that kind of journey, figuring out what you're all about, and that it is rewarding in the end to step back and try to better yourself.
And here's what Daniel had to say.
We all sort of, you know, male and female, just we all, you know, as people have faced the same sort of problems, but we just do it in, I guess, different ways. And I guess for some reason, I mean, I don't know why, you know, men are sort of in general, not specifically, you know, they're more sheltered with a lot of different issues. And I guess trying to get at that and, you know, like trying to break down that barrier is what's really important. So we all have the same issues, you know, with, a career or, you know, trying to find somebody, you know, to marry or whatever. But, you know, just we male and female just generally get at those from different, look at those from different perspectives. So just trying to have everybody looking at this, the same issue from the same perspective really sort of helps, I think.
I'd just like to end with one more clip from Rob Baldwin, one of the organizers of the Journeyman Symposium. Here's what Rob told me about what he hoped participants who attended the Journeyman Symposium would take home with them.
Personally, what I'd really like them to come away with is a little bit better notion of the reality for men about what's going on internally. Just a taste of it. Just to start to realize that what we see on the outside is just that, it's the outside, and that men are human beings, and we've been taught to put on this great heavy coat of armor on the outside, and that's what the world sees, and the rest of it we hold inside, and we struggle with the same issues that women struggle with. We struggle with intimacy and relationships and love and spirituality and sexuality and shame and powerlessness, internal powerlessness that we feel like we have to compensate for out in the world. So a little bit better notion of that men are, on internally, there really is a human being inside. And men are more and more starting to struggle to let that out and overcome the social training that we've received that is really dehumanizing, that has caused men to have to deny huge parts of their humanity. So we want to open the dialogue.
So do you feel like the dialogue's been opened?
Yes, I do. I believe that it officially has. I found that the most enlightening aspect of the symposium for me was the idea that men and women should lay down their swords and tell their stories and try to be humans together. There was one participant who was there, and as she put it, and I'm paraphrasing, but let's end the gender wars and have women and men work together against a system that doesn't work for either sex. So if that's the next movement, then I'm all for it.